allies to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, hooey, how about that Osama bin Ashcroft? Scary. And when he says, and those civil libertarians, they're the real fog of war, weakens resolve, aids terrorists. Oh, God. Imagine what he must be like just getting up. Good morning. Like a nightmare cartoon combo RoboCop football coach. So we are diving to the winter solstice, the dark out of which the hero redeemer in all of us is reborn, devoted to new, inclusive, ingeniously reverent culture. So if, as last week's guest, which will also be this week's guest, and I'll bring him on in a moment, but I'm going to get some things in because I won't need to talk once I bring Daniel Sheehan back on. But he suggested that we are in Germany in the 20s. So if now is Germany in the 20s, let's look at the potential differences in the instructions. Germany in the 1920s was a proliferation of disengaged spirituality. There was yoga, there was astrology, there was crystals, there was all this stuff, but completely disengaged. So clearly now we want engaged spirituality. And just a few announcements in regard to that. We're diving to the winter solstice. It is the turning point. And I'll be coming out to the West Coast, to the Bay Area, to give three events titled Scheherazade Saves the World. It's the power of storytelling. To redeem us all. So the three events in the Bay Area are December 20th, 7 p.m., talk at Open Secret. And you can get reservations by calling 415-457-4191. And then December 21st in Oakland, 8 p.m. at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, 27th and Harrison Streets. And that is with music by the fabulous Stephen Kent and Ida Maxime. Strong ritual. The next night, December 22nd, 8 p.m. in Palo Alto at the Cubberley Community Theater on Middlefield and San Antonio. It's the San Antonio exit off of 101. And for that, we need volunteers for Palo Alto. And if you're interested, you can call Russ Jennings, 510-601-8008, if you want to be a volunteer. So for reservations, we're throwing this together fast because the moment is so strong. And if you come to the event to gather force, we guarantee we will be creating a cauldron into which much force and rebirth is invited. Very woofy. And again, thanks with Stephen Kent, Nita Maxime, who will also be at Palo Alto. And if you're not, then wherever you are, winter solstice, it is this strong time. But for reservations for the two events, Oakland or Palo Alto, you can call 1-888-741-GODS, G-O-D-S, or online visionaryactivism.com. So Boondocks has a cartoon Thanksgiving prayer. In this time of war against Osama bin Laden and the oppressive Taliban regime, we are thankful that our leader isn't the spoiled son of a powerful politician from a wealthy oil family who's supported by religious fundamentalists, operates through clandestine organizations, has no respect for the democratic electoral process, bombs innocents, and uses war to deny people their civil rights. Amen. So we know it is a creepy powder keg, much volatility, much that we want to address all over the place. And George W. Bush just now is just nominating, ready to nominate Robert Braem III to serve as a member of the National Labor Relations Board. Braem has ties to groups that oppose women's rights, reject democracy, and believe that gays should be executed. He's tied to groups that wants to replace secular democracy with a Christian, quote-unquote, regime based on biblical law. Oh, get out the Handmaid's Tale again. Including enforcement of harsh legal code of the Old Testament, women's subservient death penalty for gays. So, well, we know that, you know, positive power surge of revelation, boom, exposure and revelation are the oxygen of democracy. Last week, we will be continuing with last week's story soon, very soon. Two stories. The previous 2 weeks we've been devoted to the Al-Qaeda endgame scenario. Again, this importance of telling stories. Their angle also is that what we're faced with the Bush regime is major incompetence, and they delineate that. Daniel Sheehan last week and soon this week will presents, you know, grand conspiracy, very tight. So we go either or both, an incompetent conspiracy. And therein perhaps lies the strategical transformational acupressure point into which to lean. The oldest frame story book that we know about, you know, many centuries before the Arabian Nights is a wonderful book called the Panchatantra, Wise Animal Fables. And it says, yet roguery can be defeated, for by its nature it is stupid. Since scamp and sneak and snake so often undertake a plan that does not thrive, The World Wags On Alive, and so we vote for that too. We'd say it's tonight also is a very strong, it's in Ramadan, it's the night of power. An extraordinary piece of fiction from The Guardian. It says this is fiction by James Buchan, but not impossible. At sundown on December 6th, well, here's just the two paragraphs. It was no ordinary evening. At sundown on December 6th, 2001, corresponding to 23 Ramadan 1422 in the lunar calendar used by the Muslims, Sheikh Abdul Rahman al-Sudi, as prayer leader of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, made his way to the pulpit in the vast mosque courtyard. It was no ordinary evening this night, December 6th, but possibly the holiest in the holiest month of Islam, the so-called Laylat al-Qadr, or the night of power, on which, according to the Quran, God's revelation was sent down to the Prophet Muhammad. On that night, better than 1,000 months, it is believed that all wishes are granted. More than 50,000 people had gathered on the hot pavement of the mosque enclosure and in the streets outside to pass the evening in prayer. Millions of others were watching on a live television broadcast as Sheikh Abdul Rahman, famous all over the Islamic world for the beauty of his voice, mounted the pulpit. A hand reached up and tugged at his robe. There was a commotion, and in the place of the imam stood a tall man, unarmed and dressed in the white cloth of the pilgrim to Mecca, and recognizable from a million television screens, Osama bin Laden, flanked by his lieutenants. It's a very interesting scenario, but for our purposes, we'll leave it there. It's about the fall of the Saudi state tonight. James Buchan is a former Middle Eastern correspondent and novelist, so that is fiction, except that tonight is the night of power on which the all wishes are granted. So we'll take that part of the scenario and say, with that in mind, last week we had deep-delving political spiritual investigator Daniel Sheehan on the show to such extraordinary response and acclaim that we have him back this week because what he has to present is so crucial for part two. So welcome back, Daniel Sheehan.
Thank you, Caroline.
So first, can we recap the almost kind of biblical etymology that we went through, you know, and I've almost got it, but I want your help and for all of our listeners too. Reinhard Galen, who has a book, right? The Service, which is his memoirs, I think.
That's right.
Okay, so Reinhard Galen, Third Reich, flees Germany, turns himself into Americans, runs U.S. anti-Soviet intelligence, and you can fill this in, begets Theodore Shackley, director of covert actions, Miami anti-Castro, Phoenix program in Vietnam, who begets George W. Bush Sr. I mean, is this right enough, or just jump in right now?
Well, depending upon how the begetting goes.
Yes.
Actually, Shackley, as I said, had become the protege of Reinhard Galen, but
yes.
That was with the direct endorsement and blessings of the nascent American Central Intelligence Agency, coming out of the first graduating class of the CIA in 1948, actually was assigned to Galen in Germany. So he was there in his official capacity as an official Central Intelligence Agency operative, and was there from 1948 all the way till 1961, when he, in fact, was transferred in to become the chief of station in Miami to run the operations against Castro. This is all in his early career, his formation, but he, of course, was one of the graduates of that school that I mentioned, the school at Oberammergau in Bavaria that was set up to train special anti-communist covert warfare specialists that was run by Otto Skorzeny, who was the Waffen-SS commander of special covert operations for the Third Reich. That's the real key to the thing that I was talking about last week, is that these 1,200 men that were trained from 1948 all the way to 1961 at the school at Oberammergau in its branch at Regensburg in Bavaria, these 1,200 men are the men who spread out into the intelligence agencies of the major NATO nations after World War II and actually became this horizontal fraternity throughout the world that was actually much more loyal. They were much more loyal to each other and to the principles that had been taught to them by Otto Skorzeny than they were to the democratic governments of NATO. And this is that coven of men who we really need to be extremely concerned about, because the principles that they were pursuing were not, in fact, just, quote, anti-communist. They were pro-something. And the something that they were pro was basically a permutation of the same thesis that was driving Germany in setting up the Third Reich. it was this drive to combine all of the major Caucasian nations of Northern Europe and North America into a major superstate that would be run for the benefit of the Caucasian minority on the planet to exploit the resources of the more aboriginal peoples of the world. That is the stealth program that actually is being pursued by George Bush Sr. As the CIA front man, basically, for Theodore Shackley, the man whom we started talking about here at the top of the show, who in fact has run covert operations for the Central Intelligence Agency and George Bush, you know, basically for since 1976.
And also just to bring up, I mean, innumerable comments and people, you know, wildly appreciative of your work from last week. And some people also said, well, wait a minute, well, George Bush is wimpy and Nancy Reagan mm-hmm. wouldn't have let him do that. And I mean, I grew up in D.C. with, you know, the children of Kermit Roosevelt and Tracy Barnes. And I mean, all these CIA guys. So my impression of the CIA, the wimpy factor, is that they were wimpy. But in the back room of the cocktail party, they'd be on the phone ordering the deaths of thousands. And so I didn't find the wimpy concern. That did come up. People said, well, George Bush is too wimpy and under Reagan's, and you would agree, I presume.
Well, actually, that's a great kind of facade that he has. I mean, you know, you got to understand that in the operations directorate of the Central Intelligence Agency, are the real wet operation people. This is the group that was run by Theodore Shackley. And all it takes is a wink and a nod from the director. So the fact that George Bush, you know, who was a fighter pilot, you know, graduated from Yale and played, you know, varsity baseball at Yale. He's not, you know, his style is very kind of aristocratic and kind of soft in that sense. But when all it really requires is that he just give a wink and a nod to a guy like Shackley, who has guys like Galen and Otto Skorzeny, you know, basically running things throughout the world. These are the people that exterminate, you know, thousands of people in Latin America. They exterminated some 200,000 people in Southeast Asia in the Phoenix program. They murdered 2 million people in Indonesia. These are things that people tend not to be taught in their high school civics courses and in their college graduate courses. But these people exterminate entire populations as a matter of policy. So, you know, these wimpy, I don't think is exactly the word that should be used to refer to.
No, it's the facade. It's interesting. And also the education. Bennett, the former drug czar, now wants to have a kindergarten patriotism class that he would be happy to conduct. And then some wonderful WAG listener wrote in last week after he said, so I love this guy, Daniel Sheehan. He's evidently the new May Brussel. I think that the Center for Visionary Activation should put out a poster or maybe placemats with pictures and names or maybe even a new board game where you roll the dice and read a card about how Bush Sr. is the Jim Henson and controls his son's every word, or maybe one of those games where you have decks of cards and you read a card and people try and guess who you are and who you had killed or replaced and who you trained to go and have whomever killed and replaced. All right, if we put the waggery aside, I mean, do you have, you know, made up, you know, kind of a list? I mean, a genealogy, a tracking system whereby people can see this visually as well?
Well, actually, we have, over the years, during the course of our professional investigation of these people, have designed major wire diagrams that it was, in fact, our office that provided the wire diagrams to Bill Webster, the head of the FBI, back in 1987, when Ross Perot, who was the on President Reagan's National Security Advisory Committee, contacted us and said, look, he wanted to present a wire diagram to Bill Webster, the head of the FBI, to conduct a major criminal investigation of these people, and contacted our office and asked us to prepare that. We did. We put that together, and Bob Fink, who was the chief investigator for Bella Abzug on the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Human Rights, personally hand-delivered this wire diagram to Bill Webster. They began the investigation back in 1986 of this entire criminal syndicate. That, in fact, is what caused the Attorney General, Edwin Meese, to come running forward on November 25th of 1986 and say, wait, we've got to have a special prosecutor appointed here so he could draft the charter that would narrow the focus of the investigation away from the general investigation that the FBI had begun secretly. And that was initiated through these conversations that we had had with the FBI and the Justice Department and the Congress to try to get a major criminal investigation mounted to these people. So we have major wire diagrams and histories of these people and detailed biographies of these people and where they intersected and where they went to school together and where they had training together and what, you know, this entire history of these people, where they track back into being, you know, in different, for example, in Southeast Asia. Many of these people came together in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War with Theodore Shackley, was the CIA station chief, Jack Singlaub, who went on to become the international director of the World Anti-Communist League, was the head of MACV-SOG, which was the big inter-military agency. Richard Secord was a major commander in the air wing of MACV-SOG. That Richard Armitage, all these people that we're talking about now, most of them had operative responsibilities in covert operations, in direct, you know, illegal paramilitary operations in Southeast Asia. They appear again in Iran when they were kind of struggling to try to save the Shah of Iran from being overthrown, and working with the SAVAK. These people appear over and over again in Latin America. They come together as this coven of people who actually function together. And in Latin America, of course, they work directly with former World War II Nazi war criminals who are in Bolivia and Uruguay and actually act as advisors to the Argentinian government and to the government of Honduras, where, you know, Negroponte, John Negroponte, who is George W. Bush's UN ambassador, you know, was the ambassador in Honduras, and they all worked directly with certified World War II war criminals who were advising the Honduran military. So these people appear over and over again. There are wire diagrams and charts and graphs of where these people have been and what their relationships are that our regular professional, you know, the way you go at it in prosecuting a criminal case is you design these wire diagrams that show their interlocking relationships, just like the mafia.
But where can we find it? I mean, do you have anything you want to put out, website or?
Well, I hadn't done that in the past. You know, we had the Christic Institute for many years, as you know. What we would do is we would prepare the cases and we would present them in court. The whole idea was to do this in a very clear, professional, prosecutorial way, where we would show what the criminal statutes were, what the overt acts that were committed, what the dates of the overt acts were, the evidence, the court admissible evidence to prove this stuff. And when we got right on the brink of presenting this in federal court, as you recall, George Bush Sr. pardoned all of these people, and therefore the civil court dismissed summarily the case that we had filed, where we were prepared to put all of this evidence on, and then ended up, as you may recall, you know, ordering the Christic Institute to have to pay all the legal fees for Oliver North and Richard Secord and all these people, because none of them were ultimately convicted of any of the charges that we made against them. But everybody who has a political IQ above room temperature knows that the stuff is true, and we're able to prove it, you know, totally. You know, so these charts exist, but we haven't, you know, put them out on the internet or, you know, gone around, you know, doing individual lectures around the country. But when people contacted me and asked me to come and talk about it, I said, yeah, we've got them. And right. Everybody knows we do.
Well, that brings us also to, you know, where we left off in the last 30 seconds. I said, you know, make a wish, Daniel Sheehan. And you did begin, we were tight then. You began to say, well, we're confronting the death wish of humanity. It's a horrible dream that is coming up. And here's what we got to do. And we also need to elect John Kerry. So that was our last 30 seconds. Yeah. And I want to go into all of that, too, and backwards and forwards as well. But yes, okay, the bad death wish coming up that we must confront and be born out of. But also, when I was talking to people about John Kerry, they were like, well, he's not so clean. He was the BCCI
investigator. That's all true.
And presumably he backed off of the BCCI investigation. They have a financial as well as an operational division.
Yeah.
And when it got too close to Democratic leadership, he backed off.
Well, that's right. That's why he has a chance of being president.
I see.
See, what we have to do, the, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And what we need to do is a transitional phase of this, is what we were touching on at the close of the show last week. It, we need to go through a transitional stage here where we try to put as much pressure as we can on the liberal wing of the Democratic Party to kind of come into a resurgence and a rebirth where they can actually nominate and get elected a liberal president like John Kerry. So that, and what we need to be able to do is to elucidate very clearly what the premises of a true liberal ethic and a liberal paradigm really are, what the cosmology is, what the epistemology is, what the teleology of a liberal ethic is. We need to hold them to this, and if they want to get the votes of the liberal people of our country, they're going to need to comport their conduct and policies with liberal principles. And in that trend, we can then, in a more progressive way, start to articulate what the distinctive qualities and characteristics are of a genuinely progressive paradigm. You can't really go around, you know, elucidating the details of a progressive paradigm when you're teetering on the brink of an argument between conservatives and fascists as to which ones are going to really be in the ascendancy in our government. So what we really need to do, in my opinion, is to put on maximum pressure to try to compel, you know, institutions such as Harvard University, which is kind of the seat of the liberal ethic and paradigm in North America, at least, to try to get them to come forward, to put maximum pressure on revivifying and resurrecting the bona fides of the liberal ethic so that we can elucidate those principles and hold John Kerry to those principles and then go through this transition of him being elected in 2004 and then potentially reelected in 2008. And then by the time we get to 2012, we're really postured at that point to really bring forth a major progressive paradigm that can elucidate alternative principles to the classic Republican and Democratic coalition to move these things into place starting at the dawn of the genuinely new era of 2012, so that while that becomes the end of the previous period of history, it can actually open on to a brand new era of history beginning in 2012, rather than leading to the termination of a thermonuclear holocaust between China and this new northern industrial alliance that the Republican and Democratic coalition is attempting to move into place.
So as we brought up also last week too, so you think that that's the deal, that it is an all-white deal, but even though China was voted into the WTO right after September 11th,
yeah,
kind of poised choreography.
Yeah, I think that what they're really hoping to do is to be able to get China to while it's still vulnerable, you know, it only has a handful of nuclear missiles right now. You know, there's like about a dozen or so that they have really operative nuclear weapons right now, nuclear missiles. And the fact of the matter is the United States is trying to pressure, or the Northern Industrial Alliance, actually, of NAFTA and GATT, are trying to pressure and bribe and cajole China into agreeing to become a very junior partner in a world capitalist scheme. Not where they're actually going to be able to participate in major decision-making, but that they're going to open their resources to the exploitation of the Northern Industrial Alliance. They're not going to be brought on as full partners into, you know, into the Northern Industrial Alliance. You're going to see that. It's going to be Russia, the new Caucasian Russia, as we pointed out, now that it has spun off its ethnic provinces, which are primarily Asian and Islamic. That's the G8 that we're really looking at now. And what you're going to see is they're going to start to exclude Japan. Japan is going to be pushed over into the Asian theater, where China and the new Asian empire is going to be, as Samuel P. Huntington points out in his work that I discussed last week, his whole Clash of Civilizations, has said, look it, let's understand that the Asian empire, which includes not only China but also Japan in Southeast Asia, are going to be isolated in a certain sense from the Northern Industrial Alliance, and they're going to be allowed to develop on their own, but we're not going to help them. But what we've seen on September 17th, just 5 or 6 days after the September 11th attack, the United States held out this kind of olive branch to China to say, look, we're getting set to kick some major butt here. And if you don't want to be one of the kickies, then if you'll agree to endorse our coming on as the major anti-terrorist power in the world, we will agree to allow you into the World Trade Organization, and you're going to have to open up all of your markets to us. So that's what I think we see happening here. There's a, in a sense, a caveat, a temporary offer is being made to China here as the real offensive operation is being mounted by the Northern Industrial Alliance to focus on and kind of stomp on the Islamic world. What they're doing is saying, China, if you want to just stand aside and agree not to come to the aid of the Islamic world, we'll in fact give you this soporific. We'll give you partnership and participation in the WTO, but you're going to have to open your markets to our exploitation. And if China doesn't agree to that, if they try to basically come on and become a major economic power, you're going to see a rise of the theory that is set forth by Samuel Huntington, that it's going to be a fundamental dialectical dynamic between the Northern Industrial Alliance and China, which he projects even in his own article in June of 1993 in the Foreign Affairs magazine, and then goes on to extrapolate in great detail in his 1996 book of the same title, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. He has six full pages where he sets forth alternative scenarios pursuant to which the Northern Industrial Alliance has a major nuclear confrontation with China by the year 2012. So this has to be avoided.
Yes. We were going to throw this one into the cauldron, but he's a Harvard guy, so Harvard is not just a bastion.
No, that's right. There's guys like Kissinger who have been around there who are basically second and third paradigm, you know, advocates instead of the classic fifth paradigm, you know, liberals. But the dominant ideology of Harvard University is primarily liberal. And therefore is subject to substantial criticism from a more progressive perspective, but it's also regularly criticized from the conservative point of view as being liberal. Now, I, having spent many years there, believe that to be true.
So, yes, 8 million things. I've been talking a lot about the show we did last week with many, many people, and it resonates in very apparently conservative group. People go, oh, we want to hear this story. One person said, so basically Osama bin Laden is correct in his analysis. And that's sort of what we're implying, too. And with John Kerry in this sort of imperfect shadow reflection, too, mm-hmm. you're saying that he would basically be our Hamid Karzai, our interim government of Afghanistan. Hamid Karzai,
right.
who is recently recovering from almost being taken out by a U.S. bomb that killed at least three American soldiers and uncounted Northern Alliance.
Right.
Hamid Karzai is a student of Gandhi. We just would hope a little more of that would come up. So we have a transitional government. That's the John Kerry story.
That's right.
Sorry, interim government. Okay, I can go for that. But
and you'd have people from ACLU. You know, he'd bring people from the American Civil Liberties Union into the Justice Department. He'd bring people from the, you know, Institute for Policy Studies.
He'd release them from Osama bin Ashcroft's prisons, basically. Yeah, that's right. But also, what about the idea that America very soon, I forget what the projection is, will not be a majority white country?
No, I know. But the fact of the matter is that a significant plurality of a lot of the non-Caucasian people, you know, understand, are not in fact full authorized citizens. They aren't voting. That is a major issue. So these parties focus just on registered voters, and you understand that in off-election years, only 33% of the eligible voters even vote. So all they're looking for is a majority of the 33%. So with 16 to 18% of the vote, they can stay in power because they're very well organized and focused to do that. And
at the end of this break, we'll
take up how we can focus on organizing our constituencies to actually get in the field and effectively counter this.
Exactly. Thank you. That's right. So we are reluctantly going to take a break. If you want a copy of this show, or tickets for the winter solstice, both, you can call 1-888-741-GODS, G-O-D-S, and you can join us after break at 510-848-4425. We'll be right back with our ally, Daniel Sheehan.
The program was broadcast a few weeks ago, so do not try to call in. Back to Caroline Casey, the visionary activist with Dan Sheehan. Tapes available 888-741-GODS, G-O-D-S, 888-741-GODS. Her website, visionaryactivism.com, visionaryactivism.com.
I can see through your masks, you that never done nothing, but that a world war can be won. You want me to believe?
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey, and you can join us at 510 510- 1-888-848-4425. Our guest today is Daniel Sheehan with his spellbinding stories of what we should really know, Grand Conspiracy. And I just want also, when we, as we want to focus, and as you say, yeah, focus on what to do, and how do we organize ourselves for resurgent, reverent culture, rebirth, and triumphing over all that we're facing. There was a good letter written December 4th by Henry Waxman from California, Representative, to Cheney. You know, dear, and this I think could be significant, and let me just, two paragraphs and then pitch it back to you, Daniel. But, dear Mr. Vice President, I'm writing to ask you that you release information about secret contacts your Energy Task Force had with Enron Corporation, which filed for bankruptcy on December 2nd. Press reports indicate that Enron, a major Republican contributor, had detailed communications with the task force and other senior administration officials. In light of Enron's financial collapse, it's important to know whether Enron communicated pertinent facts about its financial situation to the task force. It's also important to know to what extent the task force relied on information from Enron that may have been unreliable or self-serving. It's a good letter, and it finishes with, further complicating this extraordinary situation is the fact that senior Enron executives were enriching themselves at the same time that Enron was lavishing large campaign contributions on President Bush and the Republican Party and apparently influencing the administration's energy policies. Senior Enron executives who were in a position to know about the company's undisclosed losses reaped huge profits by selling company stock. Enron officials sold 1.8 million shares valued at $106 million through July of this year. According to corporate filings, Mr. Lay realized $123 million in 2000 by exercising stock options. In addition, Mr. Lay has cashed in just now shares for a further $25 million. This is while, a gazillion people are without their pensions now. At the very least, the confluence of these actions create an appearance of impropriety. I urge you to reevaluate your refusal to provide the public with information about the administration's dealings with Enron. Enron's collapse has shaken public confidence in energy markets. Continued secrecy from the White House will only compound public concerns. Sincerely, Henry Waxman, ranking minority member. So on the level of exposure, when you say, how can we focus on what we need to do? One, telling the stories that you're telling that are so crucial about, look at these patterns. Do you also take heart in, say, Waxman's letter going, all right, let's expose Enron. Where's the chink, in terms of where we begin to have revelations that can awaken the majority in this country?
Well, I don't think you're going to get that from the Democratic Party, even though Waxman's a good liberal and John Kerry are good liberals. They're not going to really solve the problem. What they really need to do is to stop the major blood flow right now. You know, they've got to, with the extreme right-wing elements, the Republican Party in control like this, you've got major open wounds here, constitutional bleeding going on, and an actual gravitation toward national security state structures. That has to be stopped. The liberals will do that. What they won't do is solve the fundamental public policy problems. Because they're wedded to capitalism, they're wedded to what they refer to as permissive cornucopia as the basic operative governing principle for Western civilization. And all they really want to do is to better address these classic list of major global problems. They aren't really out to solve them. So that I think what we need to do is, in a sense, stop the major bleeding right now by getting liberals in. It isn't going to do any good. You know, this letter that Henry wrote, to the vice president doesn't have the slightest intention of actually having Cheney, reveal this information to anybody. Nor does he really believe that Enron, let's see what your communications were with Enron, because maybe they didn't reveal the fact that they were $580 million debt that they were concealing. No, Henry nor anybody else believes that they're going to do that, reveal that. All this is posturing. The Republicans and Democrats use major public policy problems to posture and to deceive people. They don't do anything to really solve the fundamental problems. So, the Republican-Democratic debate going on between kind of the new, more moderate Democratic Party and the conservative Republican Party, and even the kind of reactionaries who were at the right wing of the Republican Party, aren't going to really solve anything. But what we do need to do is to get the liberals back into the debate and back into the discussion. We've got to re-authenticate the liberal dynamic and the liberal paradigm to be participants in that discussion, not because the liberals are going to ultimately solve anything, but because we have to re-legitimatize a genuine progressive discussion. And as I pointed out last week, I do not believe that we can allow the major, our generation, for example, 82 million people born between 1942 and 1963, we can't allow us to get caught in the trap of simply trying to go down that classic secular Marxist materialist antithesis to national state capitalism as trying to figure out what the solution is. It's perfectly clear that that's a bankrupt option. Now, that's going to generate a number of calls, I assume, but what I'm suggesting is that a genuine sixth paradigm, which is a natural law-grounded paradigm, understanding quantum physics, understanding the kind of unistic consciousness that the human being that we have as a latent faculty of discernment, to be able to discern experientially what is harmonious or disharmonious to the natural order of being, and to utilize this as an organizing principle pursuant to which we can identify principles, policies, and concrete programs that genuinely offer solutions to the major planetary problems. This is what really has to be done, not in some kind of dialectical, bipolar confrontation with the capitalists, but in fact to generate a positive organizing principle, not only for the 82 members of our generation, but the 75 million members of the millennial generation, tens of thousands of new voters of which are going to be coming into the voting pool every single year for the next 10 years. This is a major campaign that has to be undertaken. We need to vision forth a positive, concrete, constructive form of policies which we can advocate rather than simply spend our time criticizing in an adversarial way the very criticizable policies of the Republican Party, or holding out hope that somehow the Democrats or the liberals are really going to solve anything, because they're not going to.
No, that's beautiful, and very, very irresistibly eloquent, and completely that's good, and it does begin to address that issue of how do we ignite a kind of passionate fire when you're going, all right, it's a Gore kind of a thing, it's a Kerry thing. Yes, he's compromised, but we're gonna go. I mean, Gore did win after all, so you know what the hell, it does work. You know, you go, all right, I'll vote for him. Okay.
Yeah.
But I think then exactly as you're suggesting, the undercurrent is yes, because we are assuming responsibility.
That's right.
We are going to assume responsibility for the positive vision. Here's the positive vision that we're really voting for, and we're willing to have this, you know, interim government, just like Afghanistan. So in that sense,
that's right.
Yes, that's good. All right, let's go to our first caller, Ray in San Francisco. Come in,
Daniel.
Hi, Ray.
A universe of hurt and pain. If we had another plan, though, for ourselves and our kids than to hand them over a universe of pain. And I'm wondering, this is obviously a discussion we need to have at some length. Maybe one of the questions I would like to ask first is that I'm wondering if you reflect on this and compare it with where we were at 30 years ago in the U.S. government, where we had Richard Nixon walking the plank and or getting ready to.
Yeah.
It seemed like he got off awful easy.
And oh, yeah.
What I'm wondering is if what you're thinking is we're just going to vote these suckers out, or is it going to be another major bust? And this time, are we going to hold them up to examination, and are we going to actually make them accountable for their deeds and their misdeeds, or are we going to let them off the hook again? What do you see coming up on that? Have you given that any thought yet?
Yes. I think it's an extraordinarily interesting question. It raises the whole question of the Forgiveness Commission, for example, down in South Africa after the years of apartheid. I actually sat in a safe house with Carl Jenkins, who was the CIA case officer for Rafael Chichi Quintero, who was the number two man at Ilopango under Felix Rodriguez, running all the major contra weapons supply operations. He basically pitched an offer to me saying, look, if you can get an agreement on the part of your generation that they aren't going to punish us for all these things that we've done, I will get the people from the CIA and the other people to come forth and publicly acknowledge what it is that they've been doing over all these last 50 years under the direction of both Republican and Democratic administrations, and then we can try to solve these problems now that the Cold War is basically coming to an end. This is something that our generation is really going to have to come to grips with. I have brought a number of cases over the last 30 years, from Karen Silkwood to Iran-Contra to the Greensboro civil rights case to the American Sanctuary Movement case to the federal courts. and shown them what they've done. And what they're terrified about is somehow being held legally responsible for all of this, that they're going to be punished, they're going to be imprisoned, they're going to lose their retirement benefits. I think this is a dialogue. I'm not at liberty to make unilateral decisions about this. This is something that our generation has to talk about as a whole and to dialogue with the millennial generation about what our position is on this. My sense of it is that what we need to do is to articulate a positive set of alternative policies to put into place, and we have to start to vote these people out of power. My sense of it is then what we're going to discover is that there is going to be a whole series of information coming out once we get into positions of authority, once we start getting congressional seats and senatorial seats and ended up having control of the White House and have federal judicial appointments. The problem is that the statutes of limitations will have expired on almost all of these major criminal actions, and all of the civil actions, the statute of limitations will have expired. So there has to be some set of policies that we're going to undertake pursuant to which we put clearly on the public record what it is that's happened here. For example, let me give you an example that Cy Hirsch, when he interviewed Dan Inouye, who was the United States Senate, he's the United States Senator, Democratic Senator from Hawaii, that chaired the Senate Select Committee on Iran-Contra, and he interviewed Lee Hamilton, who was in fact the chair of the House Select Committee on Iran-Contra. Both of these men acknowledged that all of the accusations that we were making at the Christic Institute about this long off-the-shelf enterprise working with Galen and all that kind of stuff, this was all true. The problem is that if this were publicly acknowledged, they would have then had to have impeached not only Ronald Reagan, but George Bush and Ed Meese and about a dozen other major leaders of the administration. And it would, quote, it would have destabilized the entire American administration right at that unique point in history where Gorbachev was making all of these unilateral concessions to the West. And therefore, we had to allow these type of criminal activities to be swept under the carpet in order to get the long-range political benefits of what the concessions were that were being made. Now, that I think that's total crap and bogus. I think it wasn't true and it wasn't necessary. I think we had a golden opportunity right there at the end of the Cold War to basically put the CIA out to pasture, to say, look, this was a unique organization created in 1947 to deal with the KGB in the Cold War. Now the Cold War is over. Let's put them out to pasture. Instead of that, the Republicans and Democrats came to their aid and concealed all that information and rationalized it all throughout Washington, D.C. on the grounds that this was essential to keep a stable organization that could codify all of the benefits. Now, the fact of the matter is that history, no matter what one chooses to view, how to view that, cannot allow that kind of information to stay secret. There has to be some kind of set of tribunals that need to be brought in. When in fact, we come to power, when our generation now gets over the longest protracted adolescence in the history of the human family, and we come to understand that in addition to just criticizing our parents' generation, we have to now take responsibility and put in affirmative programs, concrete programs. What's our taxing program going to look like? What kind of defense policies are we going to have? What kind of environmental policies? How do we balance that with the needs of business and enterprise? How are we going to deal with the issue of capitalism? How are we going to deal with the kind of the fundamental criticisms that we've been making over the past 30 years now that we're in charge? And what kind of a world are we going to be passing on to our millennial generation children? These are things we need to decide. But in that context, I believe there needs to be some set of tribunals that are going to be put together, that are going to elucidate this information, clearly put this information on the public record, and it can't be done in a political context of just, well, let's have the Republicans and Democrats decide how much they're going to publicly reveal. We've got to have a new natural law-based party. A natural law-based party, not a theologically based party, which is a seventh paradigm party, but a new sixth paradigm natural law party that, as I said, integrates the insights of quantum physics, that integrates all of the new knowledge about cosmology and human biology, the latent faculties of discernment of ESP and other faculties that our human family has. Bring these into the fore and set up a positive set of alternative policies, but then set up a set of tribunals that gets a clear, objective, honest view of history that has gone on prior to the ascendancy to power of the natural law party, not so that we can necessarily put people in prison and take away their life savings and their pensions, but so that we can have a clear record, so that we can close the books on this previous war generation and have a new post-war generation of human beings across our planet that know what those facts were, come to see them as part of our prior state of evolution, and not engage in recriminations against these people necessarily, but make the record clear about what the kind of capacities were that we had in the past, the kind of things that we've done to ourselves, but have this all be part of the salvation dynamic, the salvation dynamic of our having come to an insight that these were things that we did in our more primitive states of evolution, but the fact of the matter is we can now transcend these things and have a common sharing of the resources of the world, and that, I think, is the kind of thing that we need to do.
Shoo. Okay, another 8 million things. I think Ray is right also, too, which is clearly this is the kind of discourse that we want to carry on. And to remember also that, you know, in Emma Goldman's fantastic autobiography, she reminds us that as recently as the 1930s in this country, small theaters around in small towns, you know, Baltimore, you know, whatever, all everywhere, were packed with people having this kind of discussion about what it should be, and then went to sleep. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about the Natural Law Party, I mean, you're talking about actually the Natural Law Party, which is the Maharishi Transcendental Meditation.
Well, no, not exactly. The fact of the matter is that, you know, the TM Party, the Natural Law Party that they've gotten started, there are some benefits. They're on every one of the ballots in all 50 states and every single local and state election. They have a ballot slot. The fact of the matter is they only have like 0.001% of actual candidates. They only nominate people basically that are part of the Transcendental Meditation Party. You know, what I'm saying is that we can move in and take that structure. You can basically unscrew the radiator cap on that vehicle and drive a new vehicle under it. Okay. I've had meetings with these people. They're perfectly open to having people who have earned a position of respect in the community to come in and become natural law candidates. It doesn't require them knowing anything about the Maharishi or about the Transcendental Meditation people.
They don't have their initiation mantra.
No, you don't need to do any of that stuff. But I think that they've got a basic grip on understanding that there is a natural law set of principles that function in the world, that if we can integrate those into our worldview and really put together a new worldview since 1923 to 1926 when Max Planck and the others started to make these discoveries about quantum physics, there has been no integration of these major new insights into formulating a new worldview. We're basically like at the position after Copernicus and Galileo recognized that the entire universe didn't circulate around our planet. An entire new worldview came into being that generated a huge new world of development in enlightenment, etc. We're right at the very brink of another age just like that. But we've postponed it since 1923 because of all of this dialectical confrontation between communism and capitalism. We've now come to the end of that Cold War, the end of that dialectic, and it's time for us to get back to work, to start to elucidate the particulars of this new worldview. And in my opinion, it's a natural law worldview that understands the centrality of human consciousness, the ability to direct human intentionality to inchoate quantum matter, and can increase the probabilities of manifesting a future that's consonant with our own vision of the future, rather than being wedded to some kind of set of laws that there's absolute entropy functioning in the world and everything's basically going to hell in a handbasket. That can be overcome by actual directed human intentionality in a positive dimension. That's what we need to understand. That's what we need to gather together and understand our generation in open dialogue with the millennial generation and bring forth a new vision.
No, that's completely great, because that also addresses the issue that, yes, in the 1920s in Germany, lots of yoga and crystals, but disengaged. And
that's
now the opportunity, absolutely, to assume imaginative responsibility for dreaming world into being. And what you're also suggesting, too, which is complete, that we get there by being it.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
exactly
right.
So let's due to budget cuts, I only get to hear in one headphone, so I don't know who it is in San Francisco who's our next caller. So it's someone in San Francisco.
Francisco here.
So, there you go.
Thanks for this great program. The question is, where do you see the immigrant rights movement and all the attacks against immigrants is one thing, but the kind of pro-immigrant rights movement is in this whole picture you're painting for us?
I think, obviously, one of the most important premises of this entire thesis that I'm setting forth here is that there is an attitude about the superiority of the Caucasian race that is basically driving, a driving ethic beneath the kind of organizing principles of Western civilization, this Northern Industrial Alliance. One of the ways, one of the most important ways to try to neutralize this is by actually integrating into the culture of the Northern Industrial Alliance the peoples of the rest of the world, that people from Latin America, the Hispanic people, the people from Asia, the people from Africa. That is an extraordinarily important active dynamic by means of which we can, in fact, tend to neutralize this kind of racist superiority that they feel all the time. Now, In the United States, there are some issues that our generations are going to have to deal with. This issue of, you know, we've got 280 to 300 million people in our North American continent right now, and the resources that are here need to be developed and shared with the rest of the people of the world. Obviously, that you can't have, you know, all 6 billion people of the entire planet all decide to move to North America. It would destroy the resources that are here. It would stop us from actually assisting other people in the world. Nor, in fact, do people want to do that. The real problem is that we need to get the abilities of people to develop their own resources, to own and share their own resources, to make their own decisions as to what level of development they want to live at. And this type of thing has to do with viewing an entire planetary image, not globalized under one kind of homogeneous worldview of you know, Caucasian state capitalism, but to in fact value each of the different worldviews. As you've heard me mention in passing, these worldviews of a sixth paradigm natural law worldview, or a seventh paradigm theological worldview, or a third paradigm conservative worldview, that this is an actual discipline of professional social ethicists. We need to get our generation familiar with what these categories are, and get them to understand that each and every one of these different worldviews has its lower manifestation and its higher manifestation. If we can get each of the adherents to major worldviews to move toward the higher manifestation of their own worldview and come to understand that it has great value, it has great things to contribute to the human family, each of these generates its own basic mode of spiritual expression. That, you know, you have a Taoist mode of spiritual expression from a second paradigm worldview, which is a much more elevated view than simple dialectics, of simple antagonism of A versus B, or Hegelian dialectics. A Taoist worldview that understands the kind of extraordinary dynamic between kind of the yin and the yang, and the feminine and masculine elements, the light and darkness of creation. This is a much more positive worldview.
Yeah.
And this is true of every single one of the worldviews. If we can do this, people can live in their own continents, in their own indigenous areas, develop their own resources, share in these things, and share their cultures throughout the world. Not in aimless relativism, not in kind of simple, you know, arbitrary or wooden pluralism.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like all the different massacres and exploitations that have gone on because of Shackley and all these other
yes.
characters, we the survivors of all these policies are in a large percentage, well, not a large percentage, but a lot of our folks are here now in the United States and have a role to play in the, for example, in this transitional period that you're calling. Mm-hmm. Where do you see our role playing, since a lot of our folks can't vote or barely are just citizens or, uh-huh. or are just residents?
Well, I think that my personal opinion is that every single person who demonstrates their capacity to understand the values of respecting other people and placing values at the core of their public policy decision making ought to have the right to participate in the policies that actually affect them. Now, this may, in fact, cause some significant portion of the people to try to curtail the flow of new people into our country if everyone who comes into our country is going to participate in the decision-making process. But that's a decision that we all have to make together collectively. But I think that people, the basic operative principle is that every single person has a right to participate on an equal basis in the decision-making which affects her or him and their children. So that my sense of it is that we need to open up this process of decision-making in our country to all the people that are legitimately here and participating in our country, and we ought to do that all around the world. And so that each of the local regions, and as I pointed out before, I think that what we're going to see is a gravitation away from this kind of centralizing of one huge major global government, whether it be the UN or anything else, Rather than that, we're going to see a devolvement into kind of local, bioregionally based communities that are self-sustaining and are ecologically sound. And there's going to be communication and dialogue and trade among all of these groups, utilizing the benefits of the internet now that we have, that all of these are going to be, and people that live in those indigenous areas ought to be able to participate on an equal basis in the decision-making that governs those areas. And that should be true of each continent, of each nation state, and of the planet as a whole. So I think that the right to participate in making decisions should not, in fact, be predicated upon, you know, one being an absolute permanent citizen of some place. But that's only my opinion, and I think that we need to have our generation and the millennial generation participate in a major set of discussions about what type of principles and policies are going to be implemented in making this kind of collective decision.
Great call, Francisco. Thank you very much. And also, it's everything you say. Yes, may it be so. This is a great offering. You know, in the Grail legend, it's crucial. Percival, who attains the Grail, can only do so when he finds he has an Islamic twin brother, Ferfaz. And it's only through the wedding of mystical Christianity and mystical Islam that the Grail, the kind of cornucopia, the redemptive wellspring can be attained. And I think so it is embedded in our myth that, again, what you suggest, the honoring of all traditions as well. So let's fit in our last caller, who is an ally in Oakland. Come in.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for this information. And your name is Daniel Sheehan?
Yes. Right?
And we have 30 seconds,
okay.
Is what you have.
I'm wondering, I don't have a computer, and I'm wondering how I can get a hold of it.
All right, let me give the address where anybody can write to us that wants to. It's Daniel Sheehan, Sheehan, and it's at the Christic Institute, Christic. The Christic Institute. And the address is the Blessed Sacrament Rectory, R-E-C-T-O-R-Y, the Blessed Sacrament Rectory, 160 North San Pedro Road, P-E-D-R-O, San Pedro Road, in San Rafael, R-A-F-E-L, California, 94903. That's the
Great.
New office of the Christic Institute in California.
And we're signing off. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Daniel Sheehan. That's completely great. Let's aspire to keep going, keep the conversation going. For a copy of this show, you can call 1-888-741-GODS, G-O-D-S. And thank you, producer Sally Phillips. Thank you, DC engineer Andy York. Always to Jim Bennett, our beloved carrier-on hard worker. And thank you very much to Berkeley Board Op Lisa Ballard and to the wild blooming of the compassionate trickster heart supporting such a vision as Daniel. Thank you very much, our bard, Daniel Sheehan, I think inviting us to weave a spell, to break a spell. I'm Caroline Casey. Thank you all very much.